In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Amen. Please be seated. If you've been here the last few weeks, you're aware that we've been going through several very difficult passages. Passages that shared profound, life-changing, challenging truths. Last week was maybe the most difficult of them. Remember, the 2 points from last week's message, from the gospel passage last week, were that not everyone goes to heaven, and that not everyone who thinks of themselves even as a Christian is going to heaven. And rather, the message was that you have to enter into a relationship, make a commitment to Jesus Christ. Those are difficult messages. And by contrast, this week's can seem relatively trivial. Jesus was at a dinner party, and he makes some observations about human nature. It can seem like useful advice, but not nearly as important as the things we've been talking about the last few weeks. But thinking about it that way would be a mistake. In this verse, Jesus takes a scalpel to the human heart. He performs open heart surgery on us. He points directly to one of those areas in which we are most vulnerable, most confused. And the basic message of this week's passage is this: those who seek to exalt themselves will be humbled. Those who seek to humble themselves will be exalted. It is the most counter common sense we could get. We live in a world that says you have to look out for yourself. You have to fight for your own honor. You have to fight for being the most important person around. And you need to make sure that nobody looks down on you. And Jesus says, no, that is the very opposite of the gospel message. He says, again, those who seek to exalt themselves will be humbled. Those who seek to humble themselves will be exalted. Let's unpack what he means and why this is so important for understanding the Christian life. Jesus tells this message in the context of a story. And it's a story that happens, again, as he's at a dinner party. He's invited to a dinner party by someone who's both a ruler and a member of the Pharisees. A ruler meaning simply that he's one of the wealthy and influential people in his society, one of the important people. And a Pharisee meaning that he's joined this sort of semi-formal group of people who are the most religious of folks, the people who have agreed not only to follow all of the rules of what we would call the Old Testament, but have decided to go above and beyond in their own mind. And I say in their own mind because they have crafted their own sets of rules that are more strict than what the Old Testament requires. And they have done that with an eye towards what they call building a hedge or a fence around the law. The idea that if you just do what God commands of us, you might end up accidentally breaking a law. But if you really want to be a super religious person, you'll come up with far stricter rules. A modern day example might be this. The scriptures command us to not give up meeting together. And as you unpack that from other passages of scripture, you see that we are commanded to join together to worship God. We are joined together to study the scriptures. We are called to join together to receive the Lord's Supper, the Eucharist, communion, to receive that together. And we are commanded to join together in relationship and fellowship as Christians to encourage and bless and support each other. We're commanded to do all those things. And by tradition, we most often do that on Sunday mornings. That's simply a way of honoring the day of the resurrection. Jesus was raised from the dead on a Sunday morning. And so we say, Sunday morning, that's an especially good time for us to meet together for church. And by tradition, coming once a week, really good practice, wise practice, a faithful practice. But there are some people who, for reasons outside their control, have to work on Sundays. That's okay. There are church services at other places on Sunday afternoons, on Saturday nights. I hope that you come to St. Luke's on a Sunday morning. But if there are reasons why you can't, there are other ways to come to church. All is not lost. The Pharisees would say, not only do you have to come on a Sunday morning or you're not a real Christian, they would say, just to be safe, you better come on a Sunday night also. And if there's a midweek service, you better come to that. And if there's a choir practice, you better come to that. And if there's a vestry meeting, you better come to that. And if there's a men's night, you better come to that. And if there's a First Friday, you better come to that. And if there's morning and evening prayer, you better come to, you better come to everything. You better come to everything. God didn't command you to come to everything. In fact, it would be unhealthy for you to come to everything. Most of you have spouses or children or older parents you're caring for or grandchildren and friendships. And if you were neglecting all those relationships to be at church every moment of the day, it's not that you would be balancing God with other priorities. It's that you'd actually be neglecting duties God gave you in the name of being super religious, if we could say it that way. And rest does matter. And having time to build relationships with non-Christians, how are you going to share the gospel with anyone if you're only ever with Christians? If you're never joining groups outside of the church or spending time with non-Christian friends so that you can share the gospel with them? I'm not advocating living a balanced life in the sense of balancing God with other priorities. I'm saying that following God means balancing church with other ways of following God. Come to church, but also build relationships with other people and spend time with your family and rest. Because frankly, we're all miserable sometimes. We can all be miserable people sometimes. And the church does function as a hospital for people who are being a little miserable. But it sure is nice if you come in a good mood, ready to love and support other people. Sometimes you can't help it. But being rested so that you can come to church ready to serve others is a wonderful gift. That's just an example of the Pharisees. Again, what do the Pharisees do? They create their own set of standards that they think of as going above and beyond what the ordinary religious people can do. They do that so that they're exceeding the requirements of the law, but in doing that, they actually twist the law. The Pharisees are then looking down upon other people who can't reach their standards, and they're parading their religious accomplishments. Look at all the standards I do. Again, in that example, they wouldn't just go to church every time there was anything church-related, but they would post on Facebook about every time they went to church. And they would make sure to slip in little cuts and barbs into conversations. Church was lovely on Sunday. Oh, you weren't there, sorry. Right? Little cutting remarks to make sure everyone knows that they're the most religious. This is what the Pharisees do. And so in this story, Jesus has been invited to dinner at this ruler, this Pharisee's house. I don't know why he wanted Jesus there, but I would imagine part of it is Jesus is at this point famous. He's the great prophet and teacher that's around. And so you've got to have the most important guest if you're the most important host, whether you like the guest or not, whether you want to listen to him or not, you've got to have him there. So they invite Jesus to come. And already before we get into our passage, there's already a conflict that happens. You'll notice if you look in your worship bulletin that we have verse 1 and then we skip to verse 7. Well, in between, there's a whole story of Jesus seeing somebody at this banquet, at this party, at the house, who has some sort of visual deformity or illness. We don't know exactly what it is. And he just asks the crowd, including these Pharisees, should I heal this person or not? It's the Sabbath. Heal or don't heal? What do you think? And they're really not willing to engage. They're not willing to defend their views on this. And so he simply takes this person aside and heals him. And then says, who among you, if your son fell in a well on the Sabbath, or your ox even fell in a well on the Sabbath, would wait until the next day to pull that child out of a well? Nobody would do that. So clearly, healing this person must be okay. It must be right. Don't you see the heart of God? But here these Pharisees have these rules that they have invented, right? Honor the Sabbath is the rule. Coming up with all of your little ways, you've got to do this just right to fulfill the law in ways that God didn't say, including saying, well, we can't heal anyone on the Sabbath. That's not the heart of God. That's not the intention of the law. And so he points that out in a way that's very challenging. And in that context, now we get to this passage, to what we heard today. He's looking at people arguing and fighting, or maybe doing subtle digs to make sure that they get the place of honor at the table. Normally, in our culture, we have tables that are round or tables that are square or rectangular, which makes it somewhat less clear where the positions of honor are. In fact, a lot of people, I think, like round tables because they seem very democratic, right? Well, in the ancient culture, in this ancient world, the tables, particularly at a banquet like this, were probably in more of a U shape. So it made it very clear you're at the centerpiece of the table, you're at the head of the table. And then the person on your right and your left have the next places of honor, and the people after that have the next places of honor, all the way down to you're just barely at the table. And everybody is getting ranked with where you sit. So that your exact seat makes it perfectly clear I'm less important than this person and more important than that person. Now, culturally, that's not something we have, that specific issue. But we still have lots of ways in our culture, in every culture, in which we can mark out who's more important, who's less important. It can run a whole gamut from macho, angry young men who are concerned with people disrespecting them and killing people over it, all the way up to, and I hope this doesn't name anyone, because I'm literally not thinking of anyone. I've never seen this at St. Luke's, but I've sure seen it at other churches. The little old lady who goes up to a new visitor to the church and says, "You are sitting in my seat. I have been in this seat for 40 years. This is my seat. Everyone at this church knows this is my seat. You should not be sitting in my seat." Right? Angry young man, sweetest old lady. But actually, the heart behind that is the same. My honor, what I deserve, you are disrespecting me. Don't you know who I am? Don't you know who I am? Don't you know who I am? How dare you cut in front of me? How dare you treat me that way? Treat somebody else that way, fine, but don't treat me that way. And the amazing thing is that attitude can creep up in so many different ways that none of us are really immune to that. So often it can be wrapped up in something that's legitimate, but then our hearts get involved in ways that are not legitimate. Back when I was a professor, I would meet with students, and some of them were, most of them were wonderful and generous and kind. And every now and then, someone would be incredibly disrespectful. And it was so difficult to help them learn not to be disrespectful, because being disrespectful is not good. I'm supposed to be educating and informing them. I need to help them learn to behave appropriately. I want to help them do that. But at the same time, I want to guard my own heart and my own reaction. So I remember a student who had done a particularly poor paper, and I was telling him all the things he needed to do to revise it. And I was telling him what he would need to do to get an A on the paper, because I wanted him to get an A on the paper. And his first draft was really bad. And he started getting frustrated with me. And he said, "You're not fixing it for me. You're telling me all the stuff I have to do, but you're not fixing it for me." And I said, "It's not my job to fix the paper for you. I'm telling you how you can fix the paper." And he yelled at me. This is his professor, yelled at me and said something to the effect of, "Well, you're no help at all." And I had to say that that's incredibly disrespectful. You can't talk to a professor that way. You just can't. And I had to, decide how much of a lecture he could take at that point, but I kind of had to say, "We're forming you for the rest of your life. If you talk to your boss that way, you'd be fired. You can't talk to a professor that way." But then I had to go away after that conversation and then work on my own heart, because all those barbs and temptations came up to say, "Do you know who I am? I'm your professor. You can't talk to me that way," right? It became a heart issue for me to watch my own anger. And to know as the anger was coming up, the anger was, I deserve better than that. There was a legitimate case to say to this young man, "What you're doing is really destructive. You were lazy working on that paper, and now hearing how much work you're going to need to do to fix it, you are angry enough about the work you're being asked to do that you're going to try to take shots at me to get me to rescue you or to change the standard or something like that. That's not a good attitude for your life. You need help. You need rescuing, but the rescuing you need is to face the consequences for what you've done and learn from them. But for me then to hold on to anger and think, well, I deserve better than that. Sure, you could talk to your friends that way, but don't talk to me that way. So easy for my heart to get involved in that. And probably yours too. In some way, I don't know what exactly the button is for you. Maybe it's when you get cut off in traffic. Legitimate case, you're driving unsafely and you almost hit me. Be careful, that's dangerous. Illegitimate, how dare you cut me off, right? How dare you, I need to pay you back. I'm so angry. I've gone from you're being dangerous to let me be dangerous back as I show you that I can be angrier than you. Or maybe it is an issue within family or within a friendship in which you feel like you are not being seen as of as much value as you deserve. And as soon as you find anger coming up over that, I'm not talking about a situation where someone's being abusive to you or neglectful of you, and you react in terms of saying, okay, I'm going to draw some appropriate boundaries. If you're going to be abusive to me, I'm not going to be around you. If you're going to constantly be neglectful and demand that I'm always the one who gives 100% and you give nothing back, well, then maybe this isn't a real friendship or a real relationship, and maybe I need to talk to you and say, look, if you're going to keep treating me this way, I'm going to step away from this relationship. There's appropriate ways to do that. But if your feeling instead is, I deserve so much better than you. How dare you not honor me? As soon as you find those sorts of messages going through your head, that's when you realize, wow, my heart is sure that I am an incredibly important person, and this person is less important than me. Not their behavior was inappropriate and I need to draw a line, but this person is less important than me. This person is failing to see how important I am. Remember the words of Jesus. If you exalt yourself, you will be humbled. If you humble yourself, you'll be exalted. What does it mean to exalt yourself and be humbled? Remember an example. Somebody has gone up and picked the seat of honor and said, I know that I deserve the seat of honor. I know maybe I'm not the number one spot at the table, but I've got to be at least the top five. I'll put myself in the fifth spot of honor. I'll walk up and go to the fifth best seat. He says, somebody's going to come up and say, no, 12th best seat. That's where you belong. And Jesus doesn't say what seat they deserved. Can you imagine how humiliating it would be if you really did deserve the fifth seat in terms of whatever the ranking was? Are you the oldest, most senior person here? Are you the richest person here? Are you the most educated person here? Are you the hardest working person here? Whatever it is. Even if you deserved the fifth best seat, you know it's going to happen where somebody is going to come up to you and end up disrespecting you and say, no, you really deserve the 12th best seat. My table, I'm the host, I tell you where to sit. They're going to disrespect you. And you're going to be shamed in front of everyone, you're going to be angry, and the angrier you get and the more you try to defend yourself, the worse things are going to get. You've seen this if you haven't been there. As soon as you start trying to defend yourself and how important you are, you only look kind of foolish. And the more you defend yourself, the worse it gets. The more you fight over what an important person is, you are, and you try to defend how important you are, the more ridiculous you look. I'm reading a biography of Alexander Hamilton right now. We just got to this point where there's this treaty that John Jay was arranging with England. And it was very controversial. And Alexander Hamilton, very much on the side of John Jay. And so he gets involved in these debates. And here's this guy who's one of the founding fathers, one of the most well-known and distinguished people in the American government. And he ends up standing at this like rally outside, screaming his position as people boo and hiss over him. And it gets so chaotic that he starts challenging people to fist fights in the street, saying, if you're not going to listen to me, I'll fight you, each and every one of you, one at a time. Distinguished person, but he ends up sinking to this level because he knows that he is the most brilliant person there, and if they're not going to listen to him, he'll shout louder. And if they're not going to hear his shouts, then he'll make threats. Again, intelligent, brilliant man, reduced to calling people out to try to get in fistfights. He's a middle-aged man. It's crazy. But he sinks to that level because he's trying to keep his honor and say, I'm important, listen to me, listen to me. I'm going to make you listen to me. Jesus says, don't even get involved in that. See yourself as the humble one. See yourself as the one who doesn't deserve special treatment. A lot of people misunderstand humility. They think that humility means that you always deserve the worst, or that you are the worst, that you should be beating up on yourself, that you should be thinking poorly of yourself. That's not humility. That's low self-esteem. Okay? What humility is saying, my worth is determined by God. I'm actually infinitely precious in the sight of God. And I use that word infinitely, advisedly, right? There's no real infinites in nature. There's things that are really, really big. There's no infinite. You know what is infinite? The value of God. How good, how powerful, how beautiful God is. And God himself died on a cross for you. He would have done it if it was just you. If there was no one else who needed salvation, he would have died on a cross just for you. That's your value. Your value is infinite because an infinitely valuable God died for you. Your value doesn't come from how hard you work, how accomplished you are, anything else. Because all that stuff is tiny compared to the infinite value of God dying on a cross for you. That's how important you are. So humility is looking at the people around us and saying, I'm of infinite value because God died for me, but so is she, and so is he, and so is this other person. And if I have a little bit more money, or a little bit more education, or a little bit more etiquette, or a little bit more accomplishment, or a little bit more seniority, that does not put me above anyone else. Because those are tiny things in the scope of the infinite love and value that God has for you. Those are things that are aimed at making us feel valuable over other people, putting others down to feel good about ourselves. And that is not the heart of the gospel. If we see ourselves as infinitely loved by God and also see other people as infinitely loved by God, we don't need all that junk. And we can go to a banquet and just take a seat. And if somebody then comes up to you and says, no, we actually want you at the head table, you can not only say, oh, that's nice, you can just go up to the head table and not have it be a big deal. Because it's not about your value as a human being. It's just useful for you to be at the head table. I saw this Friday night. I was very thankful. I told the bishop I was very thankful that he supplied me with an illustration. Because Friday night they had a dinner at the cathedral that was just honoring the attorneys that have been serving our diocese for the last 9 years and thanking them for all their hard work. And they very humbly said, well, yeah, we put in a lot of work, but we lost the lawsuit. You shouldn't have a dinner for us. And they said several times at the dinner, we don't deserve this. We lost. And they were amazed. They said, we work in a secular field. No one would hold a dinner for someone who lost $50 million. No one would do that. And the rest message was, but you were faithful. You did the best you could. And we are so grateful to know that everything that could be done was done for us. We lost because the courts made a bad decision. We lost because of whatever. that you were faithful and we want to honor you. Well, at that dinner, I arrive and I'm chatting with a couple other people. Juliet came with me. And the bishop comes up and says, can I sit with you guys? I want to sit with some people I know and just have a nice conversation. Can I sit with you? Absolutely. We'd love to have you sit with us. And so he sits down. And then somebody comes rushing up and says, no, we have a head table. You have to sit at the head table. The bishop says, do I have to? I'd rather just sit and talk with people I know and not sit on a head table in front of everyone so everyone can stare at me the whole night. But he said, no, we want you at the head table. You've got to sit up with the people we're honoring. So he went up there and he did it. But can you imagine how different that attitude is than saying, I'm the bishop, there better be a head table for me. I better have a special seat. Or saying, I better have a chance to give a speech. And instead he said, oh, you want me to make some remarks? Oh, okay. Right? I will if you want me to. Hadn't planned on giving a speech, but I will if you want me to. Because that's just a normal Christian, that should be a normal Christian attitude. I'm not better than anyone else. And if there are special roles to play in special places, that's one thing, right?